This episode of Hodinkee Radio is proudly brought to you by Hodinkee Insurance. It's the fastest, easiest way to insure the watches you love. Get your quote now at hodinkee.com/insurance. Hey, it's me, James Stacey, and today we have a special presentation for you featuring the audio from the Q&A that followed the recent premiere of Keeper of Time, a wonderful documentary about watches, watchmaking, and timekeeping. Moderated by our own Jack Forrester, the panel includes an incredible lineup of guests, including the director of the film, Michael Solba, Hodinkee's founder, Ben Clymer, recent Hodinkee Radio guest and AP's head of complications, Michael Friedman, author Gary Steingart, horologist William Andrews, William Messina of Messina Lab and executive producer of the film, and Brittany Nicole Cox, who is an antiquarian horologist and the owner of Memoria Technica. If you want to know more about these folks and the film and how you can see it, please visit the show notes for all the required links. The rest I will leave to Jack and the collected panelists. Here is The Allure of Watchmaking and the Notion of Time.
You know, the whole process of making this film, this is the kind of film I think a lot of us always hoped someone would make. A lot of us, especially as watch and clock collecting, interest in watches and clocks has grown over the last few years, you know, we've really been hungry for, and we didn't know what it was, some sort of document that we could show people to say, like, these things are not only worth taking seriously, but what they express about us, what they express about the fusion of craftsmanship and science and the human perception of time, it's worth considering. You know, this is something worth taking seriously and also approaching with a certain sense of humor, a certain lightheartedness that gives us insight into how we live our lives and how we can think about the beginning, the middle, and the end of it. And one of the many thoughts that I had while watching the film was, you know, I thought about the amount of time that it took for you to make it, and I was sort of seeing an analogy in, you know, to what Roger Smith went through, making his first watch and showing it to, you know, Daniels, and, you know, knowing going in that it was not good enough, and then making it better and making it better and making it better. And this film really strikes me as, you know, there's never really been anything like it, you know, in the history of cinema and in the history of the intersection between culture and horology. This is really the first true living document that looks at what fascinates us about watches and clocks from a number of different perspectives. And I was wondering if you could just sort of speak a little bit to how the process of making the film affected you, how it affected your perception of time, and how you were able to kind of see all of these different ways in which we experience the physical expression of time and integrate them.
Yeah, I mean, that was the biggest challenge. I mean, again, you know, it started with the watches. And then, you know, you look down at your wrist, or at least I did, and it's the next question is, what are they measuring? You know, what is time? And at that point, you know, listen, all of the watchmakers in horology and all that stuff is super interesting, but the film needed that sort of deeper themes and ideas about how we perceive time, how we experience it, our own, you know, that's what sort of interests me in cinema. So the idea of integrating those deeper themes and meaning and these sort of existential ideas and folding those in with these profiles of these amazing artisans and craftsmen, like, that really excited me. And at that point, that's when I thought, like, this could be a feature-length film. Because, you know, again, the watchmakers are super interesting, but if it was just a series, I mean, it would just be a series of short films without sort of that deeper theme bonding it all together.
Which, you know, I mean, it certainly would be interesting. I mean, sure, I'm seeing processes here that, you know, I was not aware before seeing this film exactly how, you know, you polish a sink so that you have, you know, sort of three dimensionality in how you polish it. One of the many things that struck me was during the section of the film that talks about the kinematics of time perception. You know, there's a measurable way in which neurologically we see time, and we know that we all process it differently. And so there are certain, like, objective realities that dictate how we perceive time and how our perception of time changes. And yet at the same time, there is such an incredible diversity of ways in which we instantiate time in our own lives. And there's something I want to sort of throw out to the folks in the panel who are collectors, who are very active in that respect is, to what extent do you, to what extent does collecting itself, does the process of collecting watches and clocks itself act as an expression of the perception of the passage of time, or does it?
I'll go first. Well, first of all, I want to just ask a question here. How many of you had never heard the term clocker before tonight? That's amazing. I will be using that in a story very soon. There's no question about that. But you know, to your question, Jack, I mean, I think it's hyper relevant. I mean, I think when I look at the past 15 years of my life, which has been Hodinkee and watches and clocks, I look at the days when I just wanted to learn and understand and touch and feel everything. And William down on the end there played a big part in that. And he was one of the first guys to take me in when he was working at Antiquorum. And then after I started to see and understand everything, I wanted to own those things. And I would do anything that I can to purchase those things and really start to understand them. And now 15 years later, I'm kind of past that point, and I just want to own the things and maintain the things that mean something to me personally. You know, in the film, you know, which was shot some years ago, I talk about, you know, my grandfather's Omega, which he gave to me and was kind of the catalyst for all this in my life. I said, you know, maybe someday I'll have a child, and maybe someday I'll wear that watch when that child is born. Late last year, I had that child, and lo and behold, that watch was on my wrist when she was born. And I think that is kind of a perfect analogy for my life, and I think many of our lives as a collector, and I'm looking at William down on the other end here, as really a representative of what all this means to all of us. And I think the things are great. And I think what was so amazing about this film is that we didn't talk about ROI. We didn't talk about how much the Daytona is selling for. In fact, I don't even think we heard the word Rolex once in the film, which is kind of remarkable.
We heard it once.
What? We heard it once. Okay, yeah.
From Mr. Steingart.
Oh, from Steingart, yeah. Okay, yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah.
Thank you.
But it was really, you know, as a collector, it really, you know, you evolve so much. And I think we all evolve as people, obviously. And it really resonates. This film really resonated to me and made me think about how much I've grown as an individual and certainly as a collector over time.
Yeah, it's you start out with sort of a focused, or more or less focused, if you're an actual collector, process of acquisition, and the acquisition itself and the evolution of how you acquire things is the meaningfulness of the activity. But then it sort of starts to become something else. William?
I have a different process than Ben. I think, you know, when you go jump, or if you start a soccer game, you have people that cross, or you have people that make a little prayer. Every time I buy a watch, I tell myself this quote from Oscar Wilde, and it's, time is a waste of money. And that's basically where I stay at. I pay my watch, and I just think about that. Sorry, Ben.
This is probably a question that's going to resonate. See what I did there? This is a question that might resonate perhaps a little bit more with some members of the panel than others. But, Will, for instance, you know, is thinking about your work with sundials, and they're extraordinarily beautiful. They're aesthetically extraordinarily beautiful. And they are, by their very nature, conceptually and physically integrated with the larger universe. And, you know, all watches and clocks are to a certain degree, but it's very explicit in your work. And while I was watching the section of the film that you're in, I was thinking about the fact that, you know, presumably all of these devices measure the same thing, whether it's, you know, a smartphone or an Apple Watch, Philippe Dufour Simplicity, or one of your sundials. And the work that you do involves shining a light, to make a obvious pun, on the different ways in which it's possible to experience the passage of time in its most fundamental way.
That's really what drew me to it. If a sundial stops working, you've got more to worry about than the time.
Yeah, you may have bigger problems.
And if you set it up correctly, it will always keep time. And I've had the good fortune during my life of working with some of the greatest collections in the world and training with exceptional people too. And I thought it would be great to create a device with no moving parts, because I know the difficulties of that and how they need cleaning and everything else like that. It actually, the idea for this particular dial came to me around 1978 or so, when I had just arrived in this country. And I met a cartographer, a British cartographer, who was living out in Chicago. And he showed me this map from 1610. And I was spellbound by it, but I wasn't able to do anything about it at the time. But after I was doing an exhibition at the Frick Collection in 2001, and 9/11 occurred then, and I realized the whole museum world was changing. And so I thought to myself, I've got to do something other than advise museums and private collectors. And so I decided to go back and start working on that. That's how it sort of evolved.
You said that one of the things that appeals to you about sundials is that you have this wonderful mechanism that's actually not a mechanism. It has no moving parts. And I guess this next one is for Michael and Brittany, because you both work in worlds that involve an awful lot of moving parts. And, you know, Brittany, one of the things that's always fascinated me about your work is you are taking things that have lost their ability to reflect themselves in our own minds, and you're returning that ability to them. That's kind of the way I've always, you know, sort of phrased itself, you know, to me. And I was wondering if you could just sort of talk about that a little bit and talk about how that kind of, what opportunities that gives you to reflect on how we perceive the passage of time as we perceive the evolution of movement in these automata.
Well, the name of my business, Memoria Technica, actually means a technical device that assists the memory. So that's very on point. I think the things that I work on, mostly the way that they manifest when they do work, that I'm kind of always competing with, is someone's memory of the thing when it worked. So, you know, I'll get maybe an antique music box that was given to someone as a wedding gift, and they've played it many, many, many years, and they're used to maybe it being a little slower than what it's like once I've, you know, serviced it and everything's lubricated, things are fixed, they're working. It actually runs faster than it did in their memory. So there's almost this competition with this memory of an object and the nostalgia that it brings to a person that is manifested in what I do.
You know, Michael, with what Audemars Piguet does, and you know, your interest in watches and watchmaking is obviously, you know, quite far ranging, and not for nothing were you introduced as a historian in this in this film. But the complexity of the mechanisms that you have sort of built your life around and built your life around understanding, it represents a very widely varied experience. You can create very varied experiences of the passage of time. And when I look at a grand complication, for instance, from Audemars Piguet, there are like multiple superimposed levels of temporal experience going on inside that mechanism. And I was wondering if you could, you know, maybe speak to that a little bit.
Before we even get to Audemars Piguet in terms of those layers, I mean, I did want to say something, by the way. Will Andrews, who wrote the book on longitude, he taught me how to read a sundial I was in my early 20s. He consulted me on exhibitions early on in my career, and it's really incredible to be here with all of you guys today. But in particular, it's not every day you get to sit next to somebody who really helped shape a career. So, Will, thank you tremendously. I couldn't say anything without...
That was gracious.
So, by the way, so those of you who know me and know how far out I can go, that's where it comes from. Like, but back to your question, Jack. In terms of layers of complications and the depth that you can go, that's precisely what happens when you get into this world of horology, whether it's through automata, whether it's through collecting. You start to dive in and see different levels and different levels of ways that time can be expressed through craft and ways that we perceive it as individuals. And complications are just different windows into that experience of what time is. A perpetual calendar is a very, very direct metaphorical link to astronomy itself. Chiming watches, as we discovered in the film, are a much more ancient relationship in that sense. Just the whole notion of what you were discussing, of the interaction and the emotional connection to it, isn't just in the observation, but it's in the touching of it as well. And when we look at watches, we're looking at the men and women who created them and who service them. We're looking at objects of permanence in this era of obsolescence as we're moving deeper and deeper into this digital age. So these objects are also changing in culture in terms of how we see them. Because 50 years ago, watches were not so distinguished from other aspects of culture. Today, they're getting further and further away from the majority of what we see and experience and consume. So that's where the beauty of complications comes in, because it really is that diving in as deep as possible into that universe of how wild can we go, how far can we go, but most importantly, through the lens of Audemars Piguet, how do we keep adding new chapters for the future? Because if we're only creating for the past, we're not going to be remembered in the future. So we're really trying to add chapters to this now. So in 100 years, these watches and clocks that are being made today are going to be part of the exhibitions of museums as they are now.
You know, Michael, something that just occurred to me while listening to you was that time is passing while a minute repeater is chiming. So by the time it gets to the end of its strike, it's already inaccurate.
This is true.
That's why
we haven't made the second repeater yet.
Yeah, to me, that's one of the beautiful kind of poignant things about watches, right? I mean, you can write down the equations for a theoretically perfect mechanical oscillator quite easily. The math is not complicated at all. And every watch is, in a sense, an attempt to get as close as it possibly can to a destination that it can never actually reach. And there's a weird kind of, there's a little bit of poignancy there, I think, but also something really beautiful.
I think you just answered your own question.
Yeah,
I don't want to add to that, Jack. I think we got to move it over here to this guy.
Well, I mean, you know, one of the things that I think about, Gary, whenever I think about what you do for a living, which despite what you say, is actually work.
Type.
A book is a brick of time, in a sense, and it's something that you can go back to and you can re-experience your psychological passage through that block of time over and over and over again. And there's always something different about how you experience it. I mean, this is the pleasure of rereading books, right? I mean, you go back for the pleasure of what you already know, but you also get the pleasure of experiencing it in a new way every time you do it.
Yeah, and I think one thing that I think unites books and watches and clocks is that they are kind of a store of time. I wrote my memoir when I was 39, and everyone kept saying, "What the hell are you doing? You know, live a little." You know, but my feeling was, first of all, I smoked a lot of pot when I was younger, and the memory wasn't doing so well. But my feeling was, I needed to have it there for my son, who was just born when I was writing that. I needed there to be a record. And I think every book I write is a record, you know. And I think of watches. We were talking about how each watch signifies something. Recently, I went through a horrific medical problem that lasted about a year. And there was one watch that I kept using, strangely enough, a Submariner with the bezel. And I needed to time some horrific procedures with it. And I thought, when I recover, I will definitely get rid of this watch, you know, because it's associated with so much pain. But when it was over, I realized I can't get rid of it just as much as I can't get rid of, you know, my anxiety and bipolar and all the other crap I have, you know. It doesn't help that I have two psychiatrists and they're both watch collectors, which is so New York, you know. And they're always goading me to buy more and more. I just got this watch because he wouldn't shut up, this guy. He said, "You're not going to heal until you get a Grand Seiko SBGW 033.
Yeah.
10 years ago, I thought books were going to go out of fashion completely. Everybody was just going to be reading on their Kindle. Books, LPs. There's so many things. I mean, you mentioned nostalgia, and there's a kind of good and a bad nostalgia. I think there's a lot of really good nostalgia happening. One of the reasons I got into watches, honestly, is that social media was destroying my life. Please follow me at Twitter, at Steingart. But still, destroying my life. And looking at the sweep of a second's hand calms me down so much, gives me such a sense of balance and proportion. And I think it's no coincidence that in the last 6 years since I've been in love with watches, all the friends that used to make fun of me and say, "What are you going to do, stamp collecting next?" You know, they're all now calling me, like, you know, the new Tudor Black Bay Pro, is it too thick at 14.1, you know? So we're all changing.
Yeah, that's... The worm turns, doesn't it?
Yeah, the worm has turned.
Okay, it's time for our ad break. And anyone who has ever bought themselves a nice watch and then tried to add it to an insurance policy will know just how big a hassle it can be to get your watch insured. You need receipts, an appraisal, a pile of photos, and lots of patience just to get your watch properly protected. Frankly, it sucks. So we decided to make something better. Hodinkee Insurance is the fastest, easiest way to insure the watches you love. Get your quote now at hodinkee.com/insurance.
There is a book that a lot of us have read. It's Harry Potter. And in Harry Potter, you have the Horcrux. And the first time I read that book and it talked about the Horcrux, I thought it was kind of like an evil watch. And that a good watch could be an Horcrux where the watchmaker has put his soul in the object. And then the first owner affects it and all the next owners will affect it in certain ways. I think that's kind of a nice way of looking at a watch as an object.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I think one of the very first experiences I had with watches was I bought a broken broken watch at a flea market, pocket watch, you know, back when dinosaurs ruled the earth. And it took me about 6 months to take it apart, clean it, put it back together, oil it, and get it running again. But, it was a 125-year-old Waltham. I think I paid $10 for it. My hair stood on end when it started ticking, and I realized that one of the things that these things do is they connect us to the people who made them and the other people who experienced them. And you can almost feel, if this doesn't sound too weird, you can almost feel friendly spirits gathering around every time you put on a watch see an amazing clock or look at a beautiful sundial. I mean, they're time machines, but they're also portals that connect us to everyone else who experienced them and everyone who made them.
You're right about that. I mean, before Will was making sundials, he worked on a lot of pretty serious clocks, just that hadn't been established yet. And one thing when we're looking at clocks and we're removing the hoods and you're going to the back of the clocks is you often will see marks of the times that it was restored. And what's fascinating is we have one of our producers, John Reardon, here. Both he and I came up together at the Willer House and Clock Museum, and these were multi-generational clockmakers. And you see actually the passage of time through the genealogy of these family members producing clocks, for the White House, like pretty serious, incredible American-made clocks. But you just don't see the name of a clockmaker on the dial. You see the names of their children and their nephews and the following generation scratched onto the back. And that just echoes your sentiment right there. And that's when you're looking at them hundreds of years later, there's a little bit of the ghost in the machine for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Michael, to a point you made earlier, it's an incredible privilege to be up here with some of the finest creative and technical minds in watch and clockmaking, and also some of the most experienced collectors, people who really have moved through the world of watches and clocks and related mechanisms incredibly thoughtfully. And as time is passing, I want to sort of make sure we give an opportunity to folks in the audience who would like to ask questions, because this is a chance that comes along. This is the first time. This is the first time for me. Just a really phenomenal collection of people. Anyone in the audience have a question they would like to ask, or a comment or thought? Yes.
I just wanted to say, when I read that book, Longitude, I was already collecting a lot of different things, but watches among. And I remember thinking to myself, here's a guy who spent his entire life and he made like six watches or six clocks. And I thought to myself, well, so many different ways of looking at it. You can look at it. There's the automatic things that were made in Europe. And then there were wars where people got wristwatch, that was a big deal. There were kings and all these other things. And I think that it's interesting that you went in the direction of the philosophical. I wanted to know a little bit more about how you decided, I mean, you said you could have made a 6-hour movie, of course, but how you decided to take it into the technical and the philosophical rather than the historical or the social, which is a whole nother aspect I think that we're all interested in. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, it certainly did start with the watches. And, the next question is, again, what were these measuring? And I think just for me personally, it's just what I'm interested in, I'm interested, like I said, more of these bigger ideas about, certainly how we experience time. I think it's interesting that these, like Jack had touched on, these objects that are measuring time are measuring something that, they're making it sort of objective. They're splicing it into segments. This is sort of what they say, the changing of the universe, right? And so that is objective in a sense, but the way we experience time is completely subjective. And I thought, I just think that the juxtaposition of that is really interesting. Yeah.
Someone else, if you want to know about the relationship between cartographic projections and sundials, now's your chance.
This question is actually, I think, for Brittany first, and then if other people want to comment, that's great too. But I just was really struck by how few women seem to be a part of this world, and I was wondering if you're comfortable talking about it, what that was like for you as you came into this profession, and how you have found that to be, and then also from the male perspective, what that's like to be in such a seemingly male world. Thank you.
Well, it doesn't not have challenges, as you might expect. I think I'm happy to say more and more women are getting into this field. So I think just basically trying to do everything as well or better than male counterparts, because people haven't always taken me seriously. I think I used to dress very, very feminine and took kind of a turn into wearing a lot of workshop clothes so that people might take me more seriously when they came into my workshop. And now I think I've just skewed back into trying to just be myself. And if I want to wear mascara, I can. You know, and it's funny. I actually forgot to wear my wristwatch today. Faux pas at this, I know. So I'm on Daisy time. I've decided that's what I'm going to go by. But yeah, it's definitely had its challenges. And one reason I wanted to start my own practice was so that I could isolate myself. And really, if I failed, it would be because of my own failings and not because I'm a woman and what has been a male-dominated field. But I am, like I said, very happy to say that there are many women entering this field. There are a lot of women watchmakers and clockmakers, and it's really inspiring, and I'm really excited to see where this field opens up and what other women will make. I'd love to see more women making watches and things of that nature.
I can tell you what, there's not a lot of women that watch collector. In case you haven't noticed, watches are shiny objects and they're made for man-childs. And that's basically why I think women don't need those little shiny objects.
I'll add to this that, I mean, I've always had mostly women friends, but through watches, I've made some man friends. And I think it's because I, you know, like William and Ben and Jack and everyone, you know, I've never had male points of sort of contact with things that men supposedly like. I don't like sports that much. I don't own a hedge fund, you know, so... But with yep. watches, I feel that a lot of men that I meet, this is their best way of communicating, because they don't know how to communicate about, you know, other things, feelings, etc. And so reference numbers and MSRPs began to stand in for that, and they really do form a kind of deep fellowship, you know, that I can't complain about and that I sometimes enjoy.
I think more and more women are involved. The curator at Greenwich now is a woman, and with the Worshipful Company of Clockmakers collection, she's been appointed. Women were involved back in the 19th century on fine piecework. You don't know them. There are very few who are actually listed, but they were making parts, and these were extremely valuable to the trade. So, in fact, women and children were engaged for certain parts.
Absolutely. And Jack, just one, I want to add a little bit. We're a little sheltered at AEP in this respect, or lucky, I should say. Our chairwoman is Jasmine Odomar, who's the great-granddaughter of the founder. The most important designer other than Gerald Genta is Jacqueline Dimier, his successor. My colleague Ginny is here, the CEO of the AEP Americas, as well as our marketing director, Kathleen. In some of the companies, things have moved fast, and it's been rooted there for a long time. And I do want to echo what everyone said here, though. There are still a lot of room to grow in that sense, and there still can be more women, as well as more people, just a greater scope of people who can be brought into this field and in this business.
We had several hands up, and I want to give a chance for as many people as possible to ask questions.
Hi. First of all, terrific film. Loved it. I have a question, and perhaps any of you can address it as a young baby collector, if you will, female, of course, but especially Michael Friedman perhaps can address this. So we're in a time where there seems to be so much hype culture happening around watches. And as somebody, or as you know, as a group of people who are collectors and are serious about this, what would you recommend in terms of going about it now as a person who is younger and who's just perhaps in the earlier stages of your collection, wanting to kind of collect things that will stand the test of time, no pun intended. So
that's a great question. Thank you for that. I'll please other people jump in as well. I think one great place to approach it as well is to look just also beyond the immediate subject of what's popular, what people are looking for. Again, even with Audemars Piguet, people talk a lot about the Royal Oak, but there's so much more and so much more history and diversity and designs and forms and shapes that predated as well as that exist today. When you jump around to brands, every brand has models that are really sought after and those where there's a lot of opportunity. Ben and I were talking about this yesterday. I love many brands. And when I was a young collector, I was really obsessed with Omega Dynamics. And these are beautiful, well-made watches that are still incredibly acquirable today. You can even in Patek Philippe, vintage Patek Philippe, there are some models that are at 20-year lows today. It's not all gone in one direction. It's really about what it is you're looking for, what's the range you want to acquire in, and then diving a little bit deeper and looking well beyond the trends. I'm not on Instagram. I don't look at secondhand values. I really just try to look with my heart and my eyes, and then to share with other people what drives them towards something. What do you love about that? That's something that we see in other fields a lot, where people are asking, hey, why do you love that object? Instead of, I like this, why do you like that? I'm interested in the more optimistic side of all of this and asking people why they're driven towards a certain object, not just watches, but anything. So, you know, inquire a little bit, see what's around, see where there's gaps in the market. You have great resources to look into that, and definitely don't buy into what you perceive as hype. Put it away and just, you know, really look with your heart.
Yeah. And if I could jump in on that one, I mean, you know, me being me, I get approached by people of some repute every day saying, hey, can you help me get a 5711 or a Daytona, et cetera. You know, the question I often ask them is just, why do you want that watch? You know, and sometimes there's a really great answer. Maybe it is, my grandfather had that watch and he was my hero. I mean, that's my story, obviously. And that totally connects with me. And that makes a lot of sense. And I would happily help those folks. A lot of times they don't really have an answer. Or the answer is, oh, my friend said it's impossible to get, or it trades for 5X retail, et cetera. And so I think, you know, asking yourself why you want something, I think is you know, kind of step one. And then I think, as Michael said, finding a niche that is really underdeveloped or underappreciated, I think is really, really fun. And one of the videos that we did earliest on in Hodinkee, actually even before we did the video on Will Andrews, which is, I think, approaching 10 years old at this point, we did a video on a guy named Gene Stone, who collected purse watches. You know, and they really look like little belt buckles. And this guy had an amazing collection of these things. I mean, hundreds of them. And, you know, it's what he loved. And they were, you know, they were kind of expensive, but not crazy expensive. And he amassed a collection of, I don't know, probably 150, 200 of them. And he is the purse watch guy and has been historically. We have a mutual friend, Jason Singer, who was a bubble back guy and then moved on to other things. And I think it's really fun when you become the expert in something particular, if that's helpful.
I'll add to what Ben just said. I just finished a book from somebody who was in the movie, Max Busser. I just finished his catalogue, Raisonné. And we went over, in 15 years, he did 180 different references, 18 calibers, which is an enormous amount of watches. And at the end, I was counting the watches he made and the early stuff. We made limited edition of 60 pieces, 70 pieces. When you count the watches, he only made 11, 10. And I was telling him, I thought you were sold out on those. And he was like, no, I just made 11 because I had 11 people that wanted the watch. And those watches now are worth, you know, a fortune. So don't go with the popular stuff. Go with what you like and give yourself a break and your taste. That, you know, be confident in what you're doing, regardless of your experience in watchmaking or as a watch collector.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you all for your contributions to this film. It's great. Sitting in this room with all these people that recognize from various different outlets and aspects of this hobby, I'm kind of building off the last question. What, in your opinion, or this for the whole panel, what can we do as a community or a group or mass of collectors in this room to preserve and build on what you've captured in the film, the hobby, collecting, watchmaking, horology? What do we do for the future as a group?
I'll have a shot at this one. When I started out, I had the good fortune to work with George Daniels for a couple of years, and also with a clockmaker called Martin Burgess. And the whole field of horology was dying. And who would want to go into horology? There was no career. You could become a watch repairman, but it wasn't terribly exciting. Wristwatches weren't visible in auctions until the late 80s. So we lived in a very different world then. George Daniels had this idea that the mechanical watch would survive, that it was, not only would it survive, but it would flourish. And he had a vision way back then that no one else had at the time. And Martin Burgess, the great clockmaker who makes sculptural clocks, he had the same vision about clocks, that clocks were like sculpture. You look at the mechanism inside, it's so wonderful, you're drawn into it. People made a big fuss about the case, but when you take the mechanism out of the case, there's a wonderful work of art in there. And a timekeeping device is an extraordinary instrument because it's got to look beautiful. It's got to be made superbly, and it's got to keep time. What is good timekeeping? If you make a piece and you get 99%, in the major universities, you would graduate with the highest honors. If you're a clockmaker or watchmaker, you'd fail instantly because 1% variation in the course of a day is about 15 minutes. John Harrison, with his timekeeper for finding longitude at sea, had to make his timekeeper keep time to within 99.99%. And today, when you look at some of these great timekeepers, people overlook the fact that they're keeping extraordinary time. I mean, we have Apple Watches, we have iPhones and things like that keep perfect time, and we rely on them. But you think of a mechanical device doing it, you know, that's 700 years of development. And out of that has come so many other things. I won't go on about it, but a mechanical watch is an absolute masterpiece.
Jack, we're going to hop up here.
Thank you very much, Mr. Friedman, for allowing me to use your mic. I wanted to go back a little bit. When you were speaking of women and wristwatches, now I know the historian here, he could better answer this, is that the first wristwatches were made for women. So it's kind of like it's funny how you say, you know, the man child, you know, the men, we kind of take this over and we love it. And segueing back to the young lady who was a new collector and she wanted to just kind of ask some questions, I think that's great. One is her just being a woman and wanting to collect watches, and the fact that wristwatches started with women, because for men it was pocket watches. And then segueing into what she wanted to know about how to think of it, and you were speaking of kind of fall into it, just kind of make it your own, as you were saying. And it brought me back to one of my first mechanical pieces, one that you also noticed, and your tourbillon is amazing, Mr. Friedman.
Not mine, it's the company's.
Listen, I know how it goes. But it brought me back into that mindset of, you know, everyone saying, hey, it's a stainless steel, you know, years back, you know, when I purchased it for my 25th birthday, well, really 26, because I look at time differently as we spoke on it. So my 25th birthday is when I turned 26. That's how I look at it. I've lived 25 years and I get to 26. And everything about, you know, the way how I think and certain things falls into it. Like, I know some of my friends, they say that I'm crazy in the essence, because I completely designed and built my whole kitchen on the basis of the design of the Royal Oak. It's kind of weird, just between just the from the tapestry dial, the bevels, and so forth. I used all these things.
Give your address at the door, they'll come film you next week. Yeah. Pointing he will be in your kitchen next week.
Yeah. I didn't place him here.
He did not, sure. But it's actually just great that it kind of fell into play. And, you know, she brought this up, and then when she said, it was like, oh, with all the hype and everything like that, what is it, how should she think of it? And it's like, no, just kind of just fall into it, what you like, you know? And for me, looking into this piece, it allows me to see so much. And just the bevels and the way how the light hits, you know, a lot of people didn't even know. Most of my friends, when I first purchased it way back, they had no idea what it was. And I'm like, don't worry about it. And looking at it now, as I've completed, you know, the kitchen and the design and everything, I'm not sure if everyone understands it, but one of the things that I took from what Audemars Piguet said, you know, well, the brand stated this, he said, before you can break the rules, you must master it. And the first time, I know that that came from a philosopher way back in history, but I got it from Audemars Piguet. That's where I got that from. And I looked at it that way. So everything in reference to how I do designs and when I build things, I look at that and I use that. So, you know, I think that was just something good for the young lady to hear and just use that to fall into, you know, her watch collecting, you know, journey.
just to be precise, because history is kind of my thing, the first person to have a wristwatch, we think, was Pauline Bonaparte, Napoleon's sister, who ordered a Breguet to make her a wristwatch. And she was kind of the first person, and yes, she was a woman.
Okay, I think we have time for one more quick one.
I have a practical question. I have exactly one antique pocket watch that was my father's, and if you know nothing except that Michael interviewed my husband for the film, Adrian Bejan, on the passage of time, where do you go to have your watch repaired? I mean, if you know nothing, what do you do?
I know a good guy in New York. I'll give him your name. I mean,
I'm serious.
Yes, seriously.
Thank you very much. And the mic goes.
Thank you so much. I was told not to do this, but I'm going to try to not have a Jennifer Lawrence moment. There we go. Well, we're rather not unexpectedly coming up on time, but I just want to thank you all for participating in this project.
Thank you.
Thanks for moderating.
Thank you to all of you.
Congrats, yeah. Mike.
Thank you.
And I want to thank, on behalf of everyone who loves watches and everyone who loves just sort of approaching life thoughtfully, Michael, I want to thank you for making this film, man.
Yes.
Thank you so much for saying so. I really appreciate it. Thank you all for coming. It's really meaningful. Thank you.